From Washington to Florida, California to Wisconsin, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Donald Trump is moving quickly on his pledge to secure the border and reduce the deep state bureaucracy. Phil Kirpin from American Commitment is here with details. Another federal budget deadline is rapidly approaching, and Congress has to pass a reconciliation bill to enact part of President Trump's agenda. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. In many instances, state constitutions do a better job of protecting our rights than does the U.S. Constitution. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine and Anthony Sander from the Institute for Justice are here to discuss. And from acquiring Greenland to taking control of the Gaza Strip, President Trump comes up with a constant stream of ideas, but his actions are more restrained. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Trump has used everything from the threat of tariffs to deploying troops to the southern border in an all-out effort to stem the flow of illegal immigration. Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. He is here to discuss. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, one of the big issues in the presidential campaign was border security, ending the influx of criminal illegal aliens into the country. As we look at President Trump's first couple of weeks in office, Phil, it appears that he's willing to use every lever at his command in order to try and bring about that security.
Yeah, one of the day one actions was reversal of essentially all of the Biden executive orders related to immigration and the border and reimposing the Trump policies from his first term. And there was a pretty immediate effect to that. If you look at the daily numbers of border encounters, they basically collapsed, from hundreds or even thousands a day to, dozens. I mean, they're in the double digits, basically. So the message has clearly been received on the other side that there's not much sense in crossing the border. You're not going to be allowed to stay with the end of catch and release. And he's also, by using his tariff threat, he's got Mexico to deploy significant additional resources to their side of the border, as well as Canada. And so, there are also significant deportations already going on, particularly of criminal illegal aliens. And we saw the spectacle of Colombia saying they wouldn't accept criminal illegal aliens back into the country, and then Trump threatened him with a tariff, and the next day they said, okay, send the planes down, we'll take them. So I think on border policy in particular, it's been a totally successful 180-degree reversal from what Biden was doing, and we've now got kind of Trump policies back in place, and their first term Trump plus more. Clearly, even just the perception that there's no sense in coming in because you're not going to be allowed to stay, I mean, that could be enough to have a huge impact on the whole issue because the arrivals have gone way down.
Now, tariffs, of course, are not necessarily the best tax or economic policy. However, Phil, we've really seen President Trump use that as a bludgeon here in order to achieve other goals. Have we really seen a president do that before?
Well, Trump did it to a certain extent in his first term, although nothing like this. I mean, he spent like years building up to it and threatening it before he actually did. This time, it's like he issues the order and it's happening tomorrow and then, okay, I'll give you 30 days. But so he's definitely using the tariff threat as a weapon to extract foreign policy concessions on other issues. And that is something we saw in the first term, that he used to get European countries to spend more on defense and meet their NATO obligations by threatening tariffs. And he used it with Mexico before for border issues as well. Look, if it's used as a threat and it extracts other policy concessions, I can see the benefit there. But I really do worry about the economic impact of these policies if they're actually put in place for any significant period of time. Particularly, what I was really concerned about coming out of the campaign was that there was going to be a big tariff on Canadian crude oil, because that would have a major impact on the price of the pump for Americans. And that would be highly economically disruptive to household and business finances if that hit. And so we pushed. In the first couple of weeks, I pushed very hard with all the people I knew in the Trump administration to say, hey, if you do the tariffs, you've got to exempt crude oil. Do not whack crude with tariffs. It'll have a really negative impact. And we weren't quite successful. They did not fully exempt crude. But when the 25% order went out for Canada, they had a 10% rate on crude. So they gave it a lesser rate, I think, because of the objections that we and other groups raised in terms of the impact that would have on Americans. And of course, now the whole thing's been delayed 30 days, and so we'll see. And maybe it'll be delayed again, and it'll just be used as kind of a threat that hangs out there. But I do really worry if these tariffs go on that they could be painful for American businesses and consumers in terms of the price impact. And so, you know, that's the push and the pull of this. If it's used as a diplomatic tool, maybe it can be a positive, but it's not very good economic policy if it actually takes effect.
The other area where President Trump is really barring in here, where other presidents have talked about it, but he's actually having an impact, he wants to really root out the deep state and cut the regulatory state down, putting Elon Musk in charge with the new Department of Government Efficiency. Bill, we've seen quite a freak out on the left over this, have we not?
Well, I think that's how you know that it's effective, is that they're absolutely squealing. They're totally out of control. And of course, you know, among the day one executive orders, Trump had a federal hiring freeze, a federal back-to-the-office order, a regulatory freeze. He reversed all of the anti-energy regulations, including the electric vehicle mandates and the home appliance mandates. And he also had, you know, withdrawals from multiple international agreements, specifically including the Paris Climate Treaty, which has a big impact on all of these domestic regulatory actions. And so, you know, there's a big sort of big bang from the first day in terms of deregulation. But, you know, we've seen that a lot of times. Presidents will come in, they'll state all their policies and executive orders, and then, you know, it takes a long time for anything to actually happen, to work through the bureaucracy. That's not what we're seeing this time. This time we're seeing not just signing paper, but immediate aggressive action, kind of being spearheaded by Musk and Doge. We've got this deferred resignation offer where anyone who, you know, basically every federal employee was told, look, if you stay, we expect you in the office every day. We expect you to work hard. We expect there to be standards of conduct and of effectiveness. And, you know, this is going to be a really serious high-intensity job. If you're not okay with that, we're going to pay you through the end of September, but then you leave. Let us know. And that's actually kind of a generous offer, if you think about it. It would pay through September. But it also sort of sets the tone because, look, if you don't take the offer and you don't meet our intense elevated expectations, you're probably going to be laid off, and then you'll get nothing or a much lesser compensation package. And of course, we're also seeing Musk take on, in particular, USAID, which is an agency that overwhelmingly was spending money on, you know, left-wing crackpot things, which I think are very difficult for the left to defend. So that was a good strategic choice of targets. And now he's got his team starting to look at Medicare payments, which I assume they're going to find vast amounts of fraud and abuse in that. And, you know, the left is going crazy, and they're saying, oh, my God, Musk wasn't elected president. It's like, well, okay, but Trump was. And all of the paper, all the memos, everything that's going out has Trump's signature on it. He agreed to all of this. He's the one doing this. And kind of the point of what he's doing is he wants the bureaucracy to actually be accountable to the elected president, not to be a permanent fourth branch of government. And, of course, if you are a beneficiary of a left-wing permanent fourth branch of government, that is a disaster for you, even though I think it's very good news for the American people.
Do you find it interesting here, Phil, that the left is having a fit about Elon Musk being given all this authority, yet they don't seem to complain about the fact that federal bureaucrats have been enacting and interpreting right. and adjudicating regulations for decades?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, I've been working 20 years on trying to restrict the power of the executive branch and put Congress into the decision loop by doing something like the RAINS Act, which we've talked about on your show many times before. And, of course, the Democrats have always been totally against it. They've been totally against any kind of meaningful congressional oversight of the agencies. Everything they've been for is, hey, you know, let the experts at the agencies, let the bureaucrats make the decisions. Don't have the political branch, don't have Congress involved. And now they're getting a little bit of taste of their own medicine with the president appointing someone to really, you know, reverse the direction on a lot of these policies that they loved when implemented inside the executive branch. Now they're being reversed inside the executive branch, and the Democrats and the media are going crazy saying, oh my God, Congress needs to act. This is usurping power from Congress. And, you know, maybe we can actually get them to come to the table on forcing these major decisions into you know, congressional votes. And, you know, maybe we could say, okay, we're willing to submit deregulatory actions to approval in Congress, but you've got to agree to submit the regulatory actions also. And we won't have this pendulum that swings with presidential elections, and we actually will force Congress to actually vote on all the major policies for the country. That would be a great outcome. And frankly, they were never going to even consider it, and maybe they still won't, but they were never going to consider it until they got a taste of their own medicine. So I'm glad they are right now.
Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. Phil, as always, tell us a little bit about American Commitment. Also, where can folks find you on the web?
We're a national free market advocacy group. We work on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory actions, and we try to find the issues that are on the margin, where if we can get people a little more information, they can maybe make a difference in a big congressional vote or in a regulatory action at an agency. So we've got a lot of letters in our action center. You can send as is or edit however you want, and we'll make sure they get delivered. And all our stuff is on AmericanCommitment.org. And then I should also mention the other group that I work with, Unleash Prosperity. We do a free daily newsletter that a lot of people really enjoy, and it's read by a lot of media and political figures. If you want to get that, I do that with Steve Moore and John Fund and a few other people. That goes out every weekday. It's free if you want to get that. It's unleashprosperity.com. And if you want my absolute up-to-the-second thoughts, I'm also a bit of an ex-addict, and you can get me on there. It's my last name, Kirpin, K-E-R-P-E-N.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Loman. Have a good one.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Been a busy week once again in Washington, D.C., as Donald Trump is going about taking care of business on a whole number of fronts. Scott, good to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be back, Loman.
A lot of Americans, I would venture to say, Scott, probably most Americans, haven't heard of USAID. However, it's been the big story this week. Want to tell us what it is and what the Trump administration has done?
USAID is the United States Agency for International Development, and it's receiving billions and billions of dollars in taxpayer money to basically do foreign aid all throughout the world and advance sometimes American priorities and sometimes more of a political agenda of a previous administration. We all recognize that Donald Trump ran on an America First agenda. And so last week, he did a little bit of a reorg and got rid of the administrator of the USAID and instead made Marco Rubio acting director and folded the responsibilities of USAID into the State Department. This week, they sent out an agency-wide memo that most employees were going to be terminated unless they served a purpose of national security, in which case they'll be folded into the State Department system. So that's really sort of been a shockwave to the Washington, D.C. area, where thousands and thousands of workers live, and certainly their families impact everything from our local economy to housing and everything far and in between. So that's been sort of fascinating to watch. Trump has also issued this directive calling on federal workers to stop working remotely and to actually show up into the office full time. And if they hadn't complied within that executive order within 30 days, there was going to be reports from all the managers in the system. And, I think what we've seen now is a lot more traffic in Washington, D.C., a city that quite honestly has quite a bit of traffic normally. So people are coming back to work for the most part. However, Trump also finally issued another directive allowing federal workers to take early retirement or termination by February 6th. In exchange, they would be paid through September 30th. We're still getting the final numbers on exactly how many federal workers took Trump up on that offer, but it's going to be far exceeding 40,000 federal workers. And ultimately, that'll reduce the size and scope of the federal government, which has really become this huge, huge leviathan and entity that infringes upon the American people's rights and uses our taxpayer dollars in ways that we're not quite comfortable with. So that's been sort of the big story here in Washington, D.C. over the last week or so.
All of this, of course, being done by executive order, but congressional action is needed in order to enact a large part of the president's agenda. That going to be done through a process known as reconciliation. Where do we stand with that, Scott? And also, we have the continuing budget resolution with another deadline about to expire.
We passed the continuing resolution to extend federal funding back in December, and it included additional supplemental funding and, you know, making sure that the Biden administration kind of could pay off all their corruption, I guess, at the end of the term. But we have an expiration of the continuing resolution on March 14th. And when that happens, you'll see a big, big negotiation between House Republicans, Senate Republicans, and the White House. You obviously need cloture on legislation like that. That's not a reconciliation package. So extending federal funding will take votes from Democrats. We need our legislators to get serious, roll up their sleeves, and make tough decisions that actually fix the economy, fix inflation, fix the printing of money, and isn't such a big concern about whether or not they're going to get reelected in 2026.
I'm really looking forward to seeing what sort of a deficit reduction is included, along with the important extension of the tax cuts. The senators, I think, have come to a good position where they're going to take on a current policy baseline, which basically assumes that the Trump tax cuts are permanent and you don't need to be paying for tax cuts. You know, it's a constant reminder for the American people. We are still collecting record levels of revenue, and we don't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. So we need to cut spending while we cut taxes.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is based in Washington, D.C., but we have members from all 50 states in the country, totaling 525,000 members. You can check us out at clubforgrowth.org and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Every state has a constitution, and often those documents do a better job of protecting our rights than does the federal constitution. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Anthony Sander of the Institute for Justice.
Well, there's always lots of talk, and there certainly will be more during the Trump administration about the constitutionality. Is certain actions that the government takes constitutional or unconstitutional? And usually when we think about that term and that sort of legal framework, we're talking about, of course, the federal constitution, the U.S. Constitution. But there are a lot of other constitutions out there. Every state has one. And when we talk about the protection of individual rights and liberties, oftentimes it's actually the state constitutions that do a better job of that. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is an expert on state constitutional issues, and he's written a piece recently that you can find at The Unpopulist talking about exactly why state constitutions are many times better than federal constitutions. He is Anthony Sanders. He's the director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice, and he joins us now here on the program. Anthony, thanks for taking some time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Eric. Appreciate it.
You've had me on your podcast in the past. It's been a little while, but you know, I guess I'm having you back here, returning the favor by having you here. Anthony's a longtime friend of mine. Really glad to have him here on the show for the first time. Again, Anthony, really fascinating piece that you've written. People can find it at The Unpopulist. That's a Substack. You can just Google The Unpopulist. Look that up. Ran about a month ago, talking about the ways in which, you know, state constitutions are better at constraining executive power and defending rights. So let's start with this. I mean, just in broad strokes, what is it that state constitutions do better than the federal one?
Yeah, well, they can do almost anything better. They don't necessarily do things better, but they can. So the important thing to keep in mind with our system of federalism is we have the U.S. Constitution, and that's the highest law of the land in every way, and it falls to the U.S. Supreme Court usually to figure out what it means. And so if you're talking about the federal government, an act of Congress, a regulation of some kind, then it's going to only be the federal constitution that constitutionally can overturn that law. Your state constitution isn't going to help. But The federal government is not the only government, believe it or not, in this country. We have state governments. We have local governments galore all over the place. Most law, the overwhelming amount of law in this country, is at the state and local level. And when you get to that point, your own state constitution can have as much to say about the enforceability of that law or that practice or that whatever at the state or local level as at the federal level. And so as Judge Jeffrey Sutton, who's a federal judge, but he writes a lot about state constitutions, likes to say, if you're challenging a law at the state or local level, you get two free throws. One is under the U.S. Constitution, and the other is under the state constitution, and yet so often we forget about that second free throw. And so that's why that I wrote that piece at The Unpopulist, trying to get people to understand that that's in the mix as well.
I want to drill down into one of the specific examples that you raise in your piece, Anthony. It's really like a practical example here. You talk about privacy protections that are oftentimes more robust under state constitutions, and I thought the point that you made about drug dogs in particular was really interesting. So tell us a bit about that if you can, because this is one area where the U.S. Supreme Court has kind of differed from what state courts have said as they've interpreted their own constitutions.
Right. So the U.S. Supreme Court has basically said a sniff's not a search. So if a drug dog is brought by your property and it alerts, you have basically no option but to let the police search your property if it's, say, a roadside stop or you have a bag somewhere, and that often can lead to very innocent people having their property seized and worse, such as if you have some cash and a drug dog alerts and that cash is perfectly legal, and yet the cop thinks, well, this has to be mixed up with drugs because of the drug dog, and then you're in a civil forfeiture proceeding. At the state level, often that can't happen because some state courts have said a sniff is a search, and it is subject to constitutional review, and so that's an instance of where your state constitution is going to give you a leg up on protecting your rights that the feds haven't allowed.
We're talking with Anthony Sanders. He's the director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. He's also an attorney for IJ. Of course, IJ does lots of fine work on many of these same issues, protecting civil liberties, defending people from civil asset forfeiture, fighting eminent domain, all of that. Now, Anthony, one of my favorite parts of the U.S. Constitution, of the federal constitution, is the one that says, you know, well, look, there's a lot of enumerated rights. We're not spelling them all out here in the Bill of Rights. We've got a lot of other stuff that is also protected, and you know, it's not necessarily all written down. States, you know, sometimes that's a tricky area in federal constitutional law because it is kind of fundamentally murky. You make the point here that states have done a much better job than in many cases of kind of spelling out and being quite clear about what rights people have, and that helps when people go to court to defend those rights.
That's right, because not every right that is going to be important is going to be written down in any constitution, whether it's the U.S. Constitution, state constitution, whatever. And yet we all understand that there's very important rights out there that aren't written down. And so one right we're very worried about at IJ that is not usually written down is your right to earn a living. And at the federal level, the U.S. Supreme Court has been quite terrible in recent decades on protecting the right to earn a living. But in state courts, that can be different. So, for example, in Georgia, just a couple years ago, the Georgia Supreme Court ruled that the state's, I'm not making this up, the state's lactation consulting license, where women who help new mothers figure out how to breastfeed, basically, had to go get a license from the state to do that. The court ruled that that was unconstitutional under the Georgia Constitution, which has a higher level of protection than the U.S. Constitution as interpreted. Unfortunately, that law probably would have been upheld in federal court, as ridiculous a law as it was. So we litigate those cases. That was a case of ours. We litigate those cases in many states that have their judiciary and their constitutions have a higher level of protection for that right and unenumerated rights and many other unenumerated rights.
Really interesting stuff. Folks, check it out in more detail. You can find Anthony's piece at The Unpopulist. That's a Substack. Find it there. The headline on that piece is state constitutions are far better at constraining executive power and defending rights than the federal one. Anthony, thanks for talking us through it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Eric.
And once again, that's Anthony Sanders. He's the director at the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. Check out their work online at ij.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Teddy Roosevelt talked softly and carried a big stick. Donald Trump talks loudly but is more nuanced in his actions, so says American Spectator editor-in-chief Dr. Paul Kengor on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Donald Trump is now president once again. And once again, that leaves the rest of America sometimes scrambling to know when to take his words literally and when to take them seriously. In that respect, we're forever indebted to the single best take on Trump, delivered way back in 2016. It came from a friend of mine, a colleague, the excellent, insightful Pittsburgh-based journalist Selena Zito. His critics take him literally, but not seriously, noted Zito, whereas his supporters take him seriously, but not literally. Right on. And once again, we're faced with that challenge when interpreting Donald Trump. This time around, it happened before his January 20th second inaugural, specifically during a wild press conference on January 6th. That press conference was one of the most entertaining and surreal that I've ever listened to. It included moments of pure inanity and insanity, with Trump talking about everything from seizing the Panama Canal and Greenland to renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America and even making Canada 51st state. Donald Trump assured a reporter that although he wouldn't use military force to make Canada a 51st state, gee, thanks, that's reassuring, he would use what he called economic force. I almost wrecked the car when I heard him say that. Politically speaking, one wonders why a Republican would even want Canada as a 51st state. In terms of electoral college votes, Canada would be another California. The Democrats would never lose the White House again. It would be death for the Republican Party. You want to make the White House forever unwinnable for the GOP? Here's how to do it. Make Canada a state. That would do it. While raging about this to a major Trump supporter, I was urged to calm down. This person told me that Trump is crazy like a fox and that he uses strong rhetoric like that for certain bargaining positions. Knowing that Trump certainly would never unilaterally say, make Canada a state. He couldn't if he wanted to. Perhaps so. Perhaps so. But at the moment, Trump sounded like a crazy man. It was like a throwback to 1898 or maybe 1823 in the Monroe Doctrine, with America the gorilla of the Western Hemisphere, with the Donald, like Teddy Roosevelt, carrying a big stick, brandishing it from his bully pulpit. And gee, we thought Donald Trump was an isolationist. Americans wanted Trump to secure the southern border, not give them Canada and Greenland. But let's take a step back. As my Trump friend urged me, calm down. We have indeed learned by now that Donald Trump is brash with his rhetoric, blurting out things and entertaining and amusing and provoking with his language. We've indeed learned that you can't always take his words too literally or seriously. On the plus side, when Trump took action in foreign policy as president from 2017 to 2021, it was usually judicious. He did not get America into reckless wars and interventions abroad. He met with Vladimir Putin and even Little Kim in North Korea. They all shook hands and got along. More important, Putin left Ukraine alone during the entirety of the Trump presidency. He didn't invade until Joe Biden came in. Putin went after Ukraine in 2014 and 2022, that is, before and after Trump. And then there was the Middle East, which, though always a volatile mess, went fairly well under Donald Trump. In fact, he gave the world a wonderful peace agreement, the Abraham Accords. Had a Democrat president done that, he would have instantly been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Trump talks tough. But as president from 2017 to 2021, he generally acted with restraint abroad. What Trump more accurately talks like is a negotiator. And a good negotiator makes big statements and big demands with a premeditated purpose of getting a mere portion of what he hoped for. And that's probably the best way to interpret Donald Trump, including, yes, even his wild statements about the Panama Canal, Greenland, and Canada. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WSIA-FM in Staten Island, New York. Welcome to our new listeners in the Empire State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.